I've been, well, reaching out for a lot of support, and even in spaces where I thought I would, you know, so I'm participating in another program with Ash, and it's like, you know, I paid for this to be business development, but that's actually not how I'm showing up every day. So even being in the space of I feel like I'm a melting ice cream cone, and all I have to offer is the authenticity of my experience. I'm like, I'm being with Lech by actually articulating it and giving respect and the time and space to it.
That's often what it needs. It's just that. It is, because there's a way in which the pushing it away is often what has it digging its heels in to say, well, if you don't want me here, I'm gonna just make sure I'm here longer, right? It's like, ah. And so sometimes just that, okay, yeah, ugh, is here too. Yeah. I was having that experience last week. I was feeling an unbelievable amount of rage in my system. Rage that we're where we are right now with everything happening in the world. Rage at systems of patriarchy and misogyny and the drivers on the street. I mean, it was just showing up in a lot of different ways. And when I was at my therapy appointment last week, I was talking about it and I said, and what's really causing it to grip is the fact that I am basically saying rage is not okay. The rest of it, it's like sadness or this or this. It's like, that's okay. I can make space for it. I can companion it. But companioning rage is hard. I mean, it's all hard. Companioning is all hard. But for me, companioning the rage is less familiar because rage is not a real common emotion for me. And it was coming in, and as soon as I'd be like, I should really not be rageful. Then it was like,
Yeah, I experienced that with needing help. The feeling of I'm overwhelmed and I need help, and that's not okay. You've asked for too much, you've had enough. Pick yourself up and don't be such a baby, is like how that my experience of what you just described. That's like, and whereas you said this is not a familiar, like it's not as familiar as some of these other emotions, rage for you, needing help is probably the most familiar, but it's like the most resisted and rejected. And so that makes it show up.
It's the least accepted in you, right? And so it keeps popping up and giving you an opportunity to work with it in large part because it's going to keep triggering and give you these opportunities or piss you off depending on what mood you're in that moment, right?
And I feel, you know, however this certainly I'll have to record some kind of intro because I just loved where we were in our private conversation. So this is now the podcast. Here we are. Welcome everybody. Britta Bushnell, she's the best. I've been thinking a lot about my own pushing, like the style of pushing or habit of pushing that has been exacerbated by like social media culture and the particular line of work that I'm in. And it's like your lived experience is the quote unquote marketing and blah blah blah, which forced me into oversharing of my brand new postpartum experience. And I now, you know, I see a lot of peers doing that. And this second pregnancy, I was able to get away with it, I think, in my first. In the second pregnancy, 3 months postpartum, it was like hard stop. I shut down in ways I had not experienced with my first or in a very, very long time. And I've been reflecting on this tendency in most of my peers and a lot of people I see, like, I feel fine, so I'm just gonna go. I have this energy, so I'm just gonna go. And then the depression shows up 3, 8 months, right. 10 years later, the prolapse shows up 5 years, 10 years later. Yeah. I have a friend who has an 8-year-old and, like, you know, in air quotes, out of nowhere, now has a stage 2 prolapse in rectocele.
Yeah.
Because she just went back to work and went, you know, I'm fine. I'm going, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And maybe, well, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, because I could keep going and I would like a pause. I'd like to hear your voice.
Well, I think there's a lot to say in response or around that. The pressures internalized and externalized to get back to our lives, you know, and I'm not even talking about bounce back, you know, I'm not even talking about like the body bounce back part. I'm just talking about the lack of space holding for the epicness of this kind of transition. Mm-hmm. And that this idea of, oh, I feel good, therefore feeling good in some way is equating with that means I can go back to being who I was or what was happening. When I actually think the feeling good is meant to just be given space as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like, what if we just said, actually, this pause is part of the transition. So, I mean, you know, and other people who do, who have trained in the birthing from within kind of method use the labyrinth as a metaphor. And that's something that Pam England taught me, you know, a couple decades ago at this point, and has been integrated deeply into my life and my work. And when I think about it as a metaphor for the process of birth and postpartum, we were always taught, you know, that the spot in the center is sort of when your baby arrives, is that moment of new parenthood. And the next thing is talking about starting the journey out. And I think we need to re-envision that a little bit to talking about the center, the pause in the middle, the not journeying.
Right. Oh my gosh. What? I mean, and there's some voice inside of me that's like, who am I if I'm not healing?
It's like,
who am I if I'm right. not actively on a healing journey?
What if we reprogrammed it to not say, okay, so you do that and then you turn around and you start heading out. It's like, whoa, wait a minute. What if we just said, no, actually what you do is you hang out in the center. And maybe that's rest. Maybe it doesn't feel at all like rest,
mm-hmm.
right? But I'm even talking, even if we separate it from the idea of the body and rest, what if we allowed it to be the rest of the psyche, the pause in the identity, the allowing? We started our private conversation talking about the meat hook, that place in the underworld of great transformation where you're caught and you can't move forward. It's like that place in the center of the labyrinth, on the meat hook, in the underworld, whatever we're talking about, where we normalize not doing, not healing, not transforming. I mean, you know, my book title is Transformed by Birth, but I want to say, let's honor and acknowledge the part of transformation that happens in the process of not thinking about or doing the transforming.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the process of gestation during pregnancy, where there's so much going on inside. We know that we've, you know, been able to study it and see it and watch it, and it's fantastic. And on the outside, my experience of pregnancy, sure, there's big changes, but it's very gradual. And from the outside, it's not like every moment of every little change and every, you know, little fingernail that's growing and this new organ, like I'm not aware of it on the outside. I only know that because of, you know, all the
scans and books and research. Yeah. And yeah, which is, you know, using some of the metaphors that I like to use, that is a very Apollonian kind of knowing.
Yeah.
That is that rational, researched, you know, medical kind of knowing of what's going on, which is a very different kind of knowing than more of that Artemisian, wild, animalistic knowing.
Connected to instincts.
That is instinctual or inspirational or biological. It's connected to something that is unseen. Right.
Yeah.
Which I use, and I know you know this, but the Greek twin gods, Apollo and Artemis, in a lot of my work. And Artemis is a moon goddess. She's about the darkness. She's about the unseen. And Apollo is a sun god. He's about the seen, the rational, the thing you can put the dots together and make into a line. And I think a lot of that gestation you're talking about, which could be something that we speak about around the transition that happens in postpartum as well, which is a unseen in the darkness reshaping that's going on, maybe not of a new entity, a new family member in our womb, but in usness, in our nervous system, in our psychology, in our curiosity about life, in what matters to us. I mean, things really often shift.
Yeah.
And we've built this overculture has been built in such a way that there's no space allowed for that.
There's something like a fixation, an obsession with the Apollonian knowing, having plans, being forward momentum, even like using paternity leave, parental leave for vacation, for a house fixer upper, like that is not what is needed.
Right.
Unless, right. And you know, you have a massive leak in your house in the baby's room or whatever, but like,
right.
Tending.
Yeah.
Just and it's being. Yeah.
It's so woven into our sort of collective psychology of this that we may not, and you know, we may be thinking, well, I feel good, so why not? I feel good, why not? It's like, yeah, if you feel good, why not? I guess. But isn't there another side to that as well? That if we started to just give ourselves a little bit more permission to inquire and check in about that big change that is occurring within us, that it might offer us something that we don't yet know is even being presented forward in an offer. Like, here you go, try, check this out. But if we don't even know to look for that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've just spent some time recently with a bunch of parents who are all with their first or subsequent kids who are under a year old. And just seeing, you know, the place of wanting to get back to normal, that, and for some of them feeling like they are back to quote normal, and the pain and the lack of space that shows up for them in the desire to get back to normal. I don't know. I'm just thinking about what it would be like if they were like, this is what is right now. I mean, this also leans back to kind of our earlier conversation of what if we made space for even those parts of our experience that are absolutely not acceptable to us.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than that feeling of, okay, now this is the worst spot, whether it's the meat hook or the center of the labyrinth or whatever it is, and being like, all right, how do I get out? How do I get out? It's like, what if we just said, okay, what do we do now? What if we just made space for what is right now?
Yeah. And in our shared language of the nervous system, it's reminiscent of the fact that trauma is created by not having the capacity to be with what is, essentially. And this plays into, you know, why postpartum support is so fundamental, because it's the tools and the resources to help you expand your capacity to be with what is, whether it is a difficult birth or an event in your pregnancy, or what is the postpartum time, which I feel like can be very traumatizing without support in that outer circle to help you just tend and stay and know that you have resources. Like, there are moments for sure when I feel like the ground is just completely falling out from underneath me and I might get swallowed up. But I know that I can call my mom, or, you know, I have resources that I can lean on and reach to say, can you come pick up my son? Can you come sit with me?
Which not very many people have some of those resources.
I don't mean to sound so naive as I ask this question, because some people don't have those resources. And I also feel pretty confident saying people who do have those resources presume they don't need them or won't need them and don't have the hard conversations to set up that expectation in their relationships.
Yes, I think that I would agree with you on that statement/question. And I would also add that those people who do have support often can then use the fact that they have support against themselves in a way that tells them they shouldn't be having the experience they're having.
Yes, that's me. You just wrote the caption for the photograph of me.
Yeah, that feeling of, well, I've got support, so why is this hard for me? Or why, or how can this be so hard? Or the self-judgment, this shouldn't be so hard for me, right? There, that feeling of this is unacceptable. that I'm still finding it challenging, and how important it is to allow space for not only that it's hard for us, but that we're having a hard time, that we're having a hard time.
Yeah.
Okay. It's like that next step. It's not just the giving ourselves permission to have a hard time, but also being very tender with the part of us that wishes it were different, wishes that we weren't having a hard time with the fact that we're having a hard time.
Yeah, I'm seeing this internal community, like the internal family systems, the internal community of these parts of self. And for me, and I'd love to hear if this is resonant for you in your own experience or what you've seen working with, you know, how many hundreds of families. It's like there are parts of me that have vanished, are gone, have died, are dying. And that is a source of loneliness.
Yes.
There are parts of me that are not there for me to lean on inside myself. And so it makes reaching out feel that much more vulnerable, because I often feel like I don't even know what I'm asking for.
Right.
I don't even know what to say. I don't know who I am in this moment. This is like just the teeniest fresh green sprout of myself that I don't know what kind of plant it is. I don't know what's growing inside of me. It's very lonely and at times just overwhelming.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's very beautifully, tenderly spoken. And I think that is precisely what we're talking about here. And what's coming up for me as I hear you and I feel you speaking that is a desire to hold space for you to mourn. Is how much we I don't want to say should, but how important giving space for mourning is in the new parent process. And I even recently worked with a couple for whom it was, in this couple, it was a man and a woman, who identify as a mom and a dad. Mm-hmm. And it was the dad who was in a deep process of mourning and very feeling like it was completely unacceptable that he was mourning his loss of parts of his identity and parts of his inner family inside his own psyche. I love the way that you said that, and how it was also wrapped up in a shame place of the feeling like he's not allowed to not like every moment of being a father. And I'm like, oh, I just, it breaks my heart and totally understand it at the same time. And that dance where and part of what was happening is that feeling of being embarrassed with his own relationship, that it's like he kind of felt like he had to hide the fact that shit was hard and he missed who he was, because in some way that would lessen his love and joy of his children. And we set up these relationships in our psyche that say, oh, if I'm having this feeling, then it must mean that I don't love my children, which is not the case. that's buying into these binaries that are littered throughout this overculture that says, if this, then that, right?
Totally.
It's like the well-meaning hospital staff who tells a really distraught parent who has just given birth by cesarean, who absolutely wanted to give birth in a way very radically different than in a surgical format, that they should be happy that they have a healthy baby, mm-hmm. that is in some way a truism that means they shouldn't still be sad, right? That those binaries, we get stuck in these binaries. And I think one of the things that I'm loving, this is going to be a tiny Britta tangent. I did Bridget because it was a combo of Britta and tangent. But I think that busting binaries is a lot of what it is we need to be doing in the culture in a grand scale. And I mean, even when talking about Apollo and Artemis and that pairing, it was like in mythology and in fairy tales, it was always seen that twins and siblings were meant to be seen as pairs, as parts of a whole, mm-hmm. rather than totally pulled and teased apart. And it's like, that coming together of understanding that there are these Apollonian sides of us and there's these Artemisian sides of us, and they intertwine and interweave and help create something that is different. And I think about parents and the place of rage or dissatisfaction or unhappiness, and how part of the cultural messaging has been that is unacceptable in parenthood. Whereas actually, if we look at it and go, wow, it's actually really important to teach our children and ourselves that we don't like things, that things make us unhappy, that we have boundaries, right? Imagine that.
And even showing kindness even when we're angry, or you know, establishing and understanding, this has been a very intense, like trial by fire learning for me as a mother, like, you know, really not liking it sometimes and showing up anyway in a way that is safe for my children and safe for me, kind for my children and kind for me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, without going on my own tangent, the painful awareness, like that sharp knife edge of awareness that like being an isolated family in my isolated house is not normal.
Right.
This isolation that has only been exacerbated by the pandemic. The pandemic is not the reason for isolation from others. Let's be honest. It's not the reason why families aren't together. It's its own thing, but we don't tend to families. We don't have spaces as mothers. Like it's a mother's group is not the same as community. It can be, but again, without going off on that tangent, I just feel that there's a significant piece missing in our innate understanding of how to mother, how to parent, how to grow healthy families that has been shut down in this pursuit of a particular kind of life and lifestyle and productivity.
Yeah. I feel some of that as well. I was really fortunate when my children were little I mean, now they're adults. So it's, I'm pulling back into the archives here on this one. When my kids were little, I mean, I remember having a newborn and having him attached to my body and cruising around my little town in the larger metropolis that is Los Angeles. So I was in a major metropolis, but also in this small town within this metropolis, and walking around my small town with my baby attached to my body, almost like ravenously hungry and on the hunt for other people with babies. I mean, I remember being like, oh, there's somebody with a baby. There's somebody with a baby. And I would go up to them. It felt so critically important to me to find other people with babies. So when you spoke about, you know, the mother's groups or the baby groups and that not being enough to create community. And I also remember how vital that piece was, how important it was, and how helpful it was to me as a new mom to end up, you know, sitting once a week with other new moms. Now, there were ways that it absolutely did not nourish my soul because I was hungry for depth and intimacy of a very particular kind, and far less interested in talking about developmental stages, yeah, diapering, feeding, what solid food are you giving now? You know, whatever those things were, like that wasn't the kind of food for my soul that I was ravenous for.
Yeah.
And when almost 3 years later, my older son was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, that baby group was my village.
Mm-hmm.
They were, they showed up for me and my family. And I had a 5-month-old and a almost 3-year-old. And it was, you know, bedlam in my life. And that community was critical. So even though it was like, there were elements where I was like, God, do we have to talk about feeding again? Like, can't we talk about like what's happening in your heart? And, yeah, and yeah, you know me well enough to know that I was asking those questions. I was going there. That's just part of who I am, but it wasn't always met, but it still fed something that I really do wish for new parents everywhere, to have some feeling of not aloneness.
Yeah, I totally agree and resonate in my own experience as a mom. I had a very powerful experience just, I don't even know what day it is. So let's say within a week.
I get it.
In a week of today, I was with another friend who gave birth 2 months ago, and our older children are roughly the same age. So we've got this really nice understanding. But it was a very profound experience of watching our older children learn to play, learn to navigate sharing and one being in another space and not sure what to do and having a very difficult time, honestly, like, should we intervene? Is this going to work out? Am I going to need to leave? And eventually something giving way and then our two kids having like the best time ever and the two of us getting to relax. And it was, what I got out of that was a sense of real togetherness and something that I feel is a bit rare, like in moms groups, like you said, it tends to drift toward, you know, the right way versus the wrong way of doing things.
Yeah. Or the practicals.
We're all here to compare and contrast.
Yeah. And the practicals of this job, quote unquote, like the tasks rather than anything much deeper.
Together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my friend and I sort of downloaded, debriefed later. It was like, that was really anxiety inducing for a little bit. I've avoided hanging out with other moms and other kids because I didn't want to deal with it. I'm trying to do this or that with my kid. And thank you for allowing space. So this didn't have to feel rushed. I didn't feel judged. And our kids got to a really great place. And it was in line with how we're choosing to parent, but also like a big learning. And that I feel, I mean, it felt like a tremendous gift and really gave me a big boost into my week where I often struggle. It was just like, I know that there's someone I can reach to for non-judgmental, just presence and togetherness instead of it. You know, I think mothering, parenting can often feel like a show, like a showing of skills, a showing of, you know, adeptness. It's like, let me tell you, I don't know what I'm doing. Yeah. Most often it's luck, just dumb luck that my kid likes what I've offered.
And to be able to just navigate uncharted territory with somebody else.
Yeah, it was so great.
Is really wonderful. And it makes me want to ask sort of like if it hadn't worked out and your kids hadn't been able to navigate the challenge, is there space in that friendship to also allow that to unfold in a way that's like, okay, or even if you may not be able to answer that question right now, but I'm even for the listeners to be thinking like finding relationships and ways where it's okay to fail together.
Yes.
Or fail isn't even the word I want, to stumble and figure it out and navigate it and be like, all right, so this isn't working. So what do we do? And let that be part of what builds the intimacy.
Well, that's so like symptomatic of this first stage of allowing space for myself to be as I am. You know, I think I know this friend of mine, she and I have been kind of walking together on this mothering journey for a while now, and I had the privilege of witnessing her birth of her second. And there's a lot of shared tendencies toward perfectionism and a real conscious unwinding of that pattern. And so we get to be in free conversation about that. And it's extending to our children. And so that was a big part of, I think, allowing whatever was going to unfold. It was like, you know, hey, I don't really know what I'm doing right now. I just need some space to figure out how I'm going to talk to my kid so that we can have some time together. Because, you know, of course it was for our children to have the benefit of a playmate. But if I'm honest, I was there for myself. So I didn't have to be alone with my children.
Of course you were. Yeah. And so, I love
addressing of our own.
Love that.
Needs.
I love hearing that you have space within that friendship for your own exploration of your perfectionism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause how important that is. So often the real suffering in parenthood is triggered by our measuring ourselves against an internalized ideal.
Yes.
That has been fed by our own parents, by society, by friends, by family, yada, yada, yada. But it is ours. It's inside us. And then what do we do with that? And how do we move and parent in a way that is softer to ourselves than always pushing up against that perfectionistic internalized ideal that causes suffering. It yeah. And we don't need more of that in parenthood.
Would you, could we stay in the archives
for a little bit? Of course, yes. I got lots and lots and lots of archives. So.
Well, your work is so, so clearly an expression of your lived experience. Like it's, as I shared with you personally, I'll speak here to the wider web of listeners. I read Transformed by Birth 3 complete times during my pregnancy, and then, you know, went back and referenced certain things for my own peace of mind and for friends. And it's just an incredible book because it has been digested and assimilated and applied in through your life. And we started our conversation, you know, just before I hit record, you were asking me about my experience, and I'm very much in a place of feeling like just total dissolve. Even though I'm 4.5 months postpartum with my second, I feel like the larva stage now, just like, ugh. And I don't know what my work will look like. I don't know what I have to say about this. I'm not interested in forcing that. And so I would love to hear some of your own journey with that kind of like pause and staying in the center or not. Like, how did that transpire through your pregnancies and postpartum experiences?
Well, I mean, I think I share, it's interesting because I'll just preface this by saying that my contract was for 60 to 70,000 words for my book. And I wrote 120. So yeah. which is basically double what my contract was for. And then went back with my editor, and a lot of it ended up on the cutting room floor. So there's these moments where I'm like, okay, do I remember if that story actually made it in the book that you all read? Or is that one of the stories that ended up on the floor? So I can't always remember. Just because I got so intimate with the content and the stories that even though I read the audiobook, and if you'd asked me the day after I read the audiobook what was in my book, I would remember. But because the content is so personal that sometimes I can't remember what's in it and what's not in it. But my experience with my first, my husband and I were living in a studio guest house when my first was born. It was one room. It had a little kitchenette. It had a bathroom. That was the only door that closed, was the bathroom, and open space where we had a little couch and we had a little, you know, bed and a desk, and everything was right there. And for the first week postpartum, my mom lived with us in that studio as well. So it was very intimate and very, very connected. And there was something about living in that simple space, in that enclosed space, in that limited space that worked for me in the early postpartum period in a way that I wouldn't have expected. Like if you'd asked me when I was pregnant, I would have been like, no, we really need to move into our house, because we were living in this studio while some work was happening in the house that we were going to move into. And of course, as Uber nesting goes, it wasn't ready. I mean, so many people Uber nest while they're while they're pregnant, and they think it's unique to them, but so often people are moving and changing and remodeling or painting or whatever is happening. And so we were in this studio for this time, and it actually slowed me down and kind of centered me. Where I got hooked was when we moved into the house. And something about moving into more space and shifting into this life that I had envisioned was where I struggled. That's when it got harder for me, in large part because when we were in the studio, I had few expectations for myself. I mean, it was just, okay, I roll from the bed and I land in what we call our living room. And then if I roll a little further, I'm in the kitchen, and oh, there's the bathroom. And it, you know, we didn't even have a closet. Okay. We had just rolling racks. I mean, it was just, there was no big expectations. It was messy. Even when it was tidy, it was messy, because it just, that was the reality of the space we were in. And so when we moved into the house, I suddenly had all these expectations of myself, of what our new house would look like and what it would be like. And that's where I started having more of a suffering experience. And it was caused from that place of having expectations of myself that perhaps, you know, ideals or perfectionism, the expectations of what I quote unquote should be able to accomplish in a 24-hour period. And I struggled, because in reality, I still needed to be in that guest house emotionally. I still just needed to be with my child and myself, and the not doingness of what was happening. And that was, it was tough.
Yeah, I am taking great comfort in that imagining of a studio space. Like, if my world were just my bedroom and this little sunroom situation that we have, it's like, yeah, limited expectations, which would be so helpful. And like, there's just only so much we can do. Mm-hmm. And sort of the, yeah, I feel that I am benefiting from limiting, which, you know, is such a dirty word in our culture, especially our self-help culture.
Right. Exactly.
Like, limiting myself to the confines of what is needed day to day. I need to eat. I need to rest. I need to feed my children. I need to get some fresh air. I need to rest. And taking pride in that and feeling satisfaction and fulfillment in that has been very, very difficult. And I think that, you know, some of that is okay. Like, it's all okay. That's the nature of the conversation we're having right now. It's all okay. But gosh, how we have almost like damaged our ability to heal and be free and at ease in our psyche with this quote unquote self-help culture. And
oh, absolutely.
Aspirational. I mean, it's all aspirational. You're never pure.
Absolutely.
Enough. You're never healthy enough. You're never good enough.
Oh, you are just speaking my language here right now, because that is such that is a rough one, that when we end up, I mean, here I am, an author of a pregnancy self-help book, more or less. I mean, that's my publisher is a publisher, it sounds true. And they're known for their self-help personal growth titles. I mean, that's what they do. And so I have this kind of uncomfortable relationship with being part of that genre, but how much there's such good stuff out there and so many opportunities to use it against ourselves. And to me, that is the place that we need to, where I want to invite us all to remain conscious, right? Yeah. To remain curious,
yeah.
Engaged is that place of, yeah, aspirational. Toxic positivity can actually work against us in ways that it can be really rough. And for new parents, what it would have been like for me to just be like, whatever it is you can do today is what you can do today. Like, wow. Like, not big expectations, just that.
Yeah.
Just that. And also noticing, and new parents talk to me about this all the time. Parents, actually, just full stop, parents, not new parents, just parents, is that feeling, especially ones who either stay at home or work at home or are primary parenting or lead parenting is a term that I like to use a lot this time. Like, who's the lead parent right now? Because sometimes you're changing who's the lead parent. It's not, you know, just the, I know that you are, yes, you are lead parenting as we record this with two at home, one on your body and the other right next to you. Yes. So here you are engaging in this conversation and recording it with me while also holding the space of lead parent. And the thing I was just going to speak to is that feeling of wanting the space to commit to something else, right? In moments when you're lead parenting and it's absolutely consuming you and you're like, oh my God, I just need space away. I remember, because I did lead parent a lot and my husband worked out of the home. My jobs were in the home. I worked from home while parenting, and he would come home at the end of his day. And I would sometimes nearly shove our children at him, right? Just that feeling of like, okay, I'm done. Here, right?
Yes, very resonant with that.
And how often shortly after doing that, there'd be a little bit of I'm not going to call it self-loathing, but self lack of acceptance of self. Like, oh, wait a minute. Wait, I do love our kids. And and it was actually a really good day. And I'll backpedal. I would backpedal in some way rather than be in a spot of saying, yeah, it was, even if it was an easy day, quote unquote, easy day, you know, or a day that flowed, let me use that term, I still hungered for time that felt more my own, more connected to self. And as my parenting journey got more mature or more engaged and more truly connected with not aspirational self-help, but true growth, what would often help is like shoving the kids at my husband and then being like, I need a break. And being able to say to myself, and this was the piece that was most important, it's okay to need a break. It's that giving self permission to take that break rather than judging in some way that I just shoved my children off to my husband, being like, yeah, no, I need that. And it's okay to need that. I feel like that's the piece we all need to really hear.
Yeah. Yeah, you and I have a mutual friend in Kimberly Johnson, and she often says, as a parent, it's not actually normal to put the oxygen mask on first. Like, you're gonna put it on your child first. You are. So when you're lead parent, everything is going out towards them. And to take a pause, to take a break, is putting the oxygen mask on yourself. Like, eventually you have to. You're going to put it on your kid first, but eventually you have to put on your own also. And that, to me, is, you know, the moments where you either get to go for a walk by yourself, or at least you've got, like, to me, it feels like for one toddler, I need at least three adults. It feels like a reasonable amount of, yeah, you know, the ratio that works best. Three adults to one toddler, I'm fine. I'm breathing easy. I'm enjoying myself. And I don't have that often.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to also just speak to something else that I sometimes found, which was sometimes it was actually easier when my husband was out of town.
So, because you weren't expecting...
There were no additional expectations. There were no, like, my expectations were lower. My expectations, what I was presuming were expectations he had on me, whether they were truly there or not, is not the point. It would be what I would create inside my own mind, mm-hmm, about, oh, okay, you know, and the number of times where my husband would be out of town on work and I would have one or two kids, and I would make dinner for them and be like, you know, I'm actually not hungry. Like, I actually don't feel like having dinner tonight. And then that would be what I would do. And that's different than how I would operate family life when everyone is in the house. I mean, to this day, there's a certain element of part of what I love most about my alone time is how easy it is for me to slip into the jet stream of my own needs. And that for me is what that solo time, that time totally alone, that solitude is about, is that when I slip into that jet stream of, what is it that I want to do in this moment? Reconnects me to a part of myself that needs nourishment, in part because then I can, I mean, it just feels good, but another part because then when I'm with other people, the echo of that part of myself, that jet stream that is totally, entirely my own creation, is easier to hear. That echo is still there. And then I'm able to kind of touch in with it, even when other people are around me.
I love that image so much. I love that phrasing, the jet stream. And I'm thinking about this, the kind of, like, I'm experiencing this part of my journey as, like, the liminal space. It's, like, quite unformed. There's not a consistent break. You know, it's the larva stage, and it's so challenging. And it is, I'm still figuring out what activities, or, you know, whatever, will provide that kind of ballast so that there is a sense of more flexibility and even joy in the intensity that is parenting. Mm-hmm. And so I'm taking such comfort in this conversation because it's a reminder. I feel like your book is so unique because it is this non-judgmental presentation of what can happen. And it just presents the, I don't know. I mean, you present these these guides from mythology and also lived experience to empower people to kind of make their own decisions and be in their own experience. It's very much a guide for folks to have their own experience of this transformative experience. So everyone read the book.
That it's is fantastic. Absolutely. I mean, thank you. That's absolutely, I mean, you just spoke to my intention for this mm-hmm. book in a thousand ways and it's, and into parenthood, because for me, it's this, the stepping through birth. I mean, birth is the vehicle for this opportunity to understand a rite of passage of profound significance, even if the event itself feels somewhat easy or challenging or whatever it is that threshold into a new type of liminal space to which you speak, and a new identity of who it is you are. I remember in writing my dissertation, doing research on rites of passage, and one of the things that happens in many rites of passage given to young people heading into adulthood is the giving of a new name. And how much that felt so connected to what my experience was stepping into motherhood, where I went from everybody calling me Britta to suddenly feeling like, I mean, yes, it took time, but the identity of mom became so profound. And for years, I was far more likely to hear the name mom than Britta.
Yeah, I love that part of your book. It's so powerful. And it happens suddenly, right? I've been reflecting a lot on how, you know, the journey to becoming Stacy as a woman, like the fulfillment of maidenhood, you know, to stay with sort of the mythological structure, took a long time. And it took a lot of really lows, like, except now it's like the children are here. I'm mother and I'm responsible to these beings, and it's going to take time to embody this. It's simply this added layer of challenge and intensity because I'm responsible.
Yeah.
In ways that I never was before.
Yeah. And like I'm now so
precious.
They are so precious. And it's so important.
I thought of myself as that precious ever.
Oh, that's so profound. Yeah. And yet now you see them as that precious, and being able to then see yourself almost through that same lens of the preciousness they help you see is huge. Speaking of sort of those archetypal transitions, I'm now on the other end of that. Simultaneously, I am in the process of having my youngest head away to college, my youngest, which means I've already done this once, right, with my oldest and my goddaughter, who, you know, is older still. So it's like, I'm on that threshold of ending that. And I'm going through menopause. It's like they're both happening at the same time. It's like, like, oh, got it. Like the identity transition, I am not likely to hear the name mom show up in my day-to-day life now. It's not something I'm always hearing. And so it's been an interesting thing. And I'm giggling because I'm wondering if there's this new identity coming, because I just received in the mail something addressed to Dr. Bushnell. I got some emails yesterday around some stuff that I'm doing, and it's involving some people who don't know me. And every response is, oh, Dr. Bushnell, thank you so much. And I'm like, oh, so is my crone identity going to be Dr. Bushnell? is that what's happening in terms of the new name piece? I don't know.
I love that.
Something's different. something is occurring. And I do think that for many of us who take on these roles in the parenting sphere, these transitions are tied up with our relationship to our children in some very profound ways. And it's that the who we are, both in relation to our children and also in relation to ourselves, mm-hmm. is like a constant dance.
I would love to kind of close with this question. What, if you can distill it down today, what is the single contribution from your experience as a mother to your work in the world? Like, what is the way that has most impacted your work in the world?
Let me make sure I grokked your question. What is the single most impactful thing from my life, personal life journey that has impacted my work in the world, my motherhood journey with my work in the world? Is that, did I get it right?
Yeah. What is the way that becoming a mother, being a mother, has shaped your work in the world?
I mean, for me?
Yeah, for you.
That is.
And I love also, I have to acknowledge that you used grok. That is such a special connection.
Not only did I use that word, I actually know its origin. And have read its origin. So I come from a long line of science fiction aficionados and things of that sort, but
I love that about you.
I mean, it's really actually challenging for me to answer that question. And for some reason, it's making me even a little bit emotional to answer it. Quite a bit, because I actually don't know how I could tease those two apart. That my motherhood journey has so profoundly impacted the work that I do in the world. And the work that I do in the world has so profoundly impacted my motherhood journey. And I mean, as you can see, I have tears in my eyes as I'm saying this. The listeners can't see my tears, but maybe they can hear them. I think back to when my husband and I were newly married, and I was hungry. I was so hungry for passion in my life, in my professional life. I was a thriving yoga teacher in the yoga scene in Los Angeles, doing well, succeeding, teaching yoga to the stars, you know, I mean, the whole like woo of LA yoga scene. And I was so not satisfied by it. And I went away with my husband. He was assisting at a workshop. And so I participated in the workshop, and the workshop was really about looking at life and goals. And it was a money workshop, but it was also about like coming into what you do. My husband's a financial planner, so that's why it makes sense that it was a money workshop. And the thing that kept coming up for me as we were doing these visualizations was I was using the workshop to inquire about what I wanted next in my career. And it was as if pulsing energy kept saying, mom, 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 you want to be a mom. And it frankly frustrated me. because I was like, no, I'm talking about what I want to do in my career. What is my career going to be? Because this yoga thing is just not satisfying me. So what's my career? And the message was just kind of like, you want to be a mom. You want to be a mom. You want to be a mom. And I was like, ugh. But ultimately there was some wisdom in that bubbling up of desire in my body and in my psyche that said, actually, these are connected impulses. The impulse that you want to be a mom that is so loudly reverberating in you, and the profound quest for purpose in a professional career path were totally and completely intertwined for me. I couldn't know that at the time. So that probably didn't answer your question and answered your question all at once.
Yes. Perfect.
In other words, there isn't just one thing. It's too hard to answer. Yeah.
I mean, it makes total sense to me. And I imagine most of the folks who are listening.
I want to just add one quick thing, mm-hmm. which is to say that both of them for me were a path. They were paths. Motherhood was a very profound growth path, personal path, physical path. And my work feels like it's been a path and mm-hmm. a spiritual path. They've been practice paths. As profound for me, or possibly, you know, I mean, I don't want to do a comparison, but to a spiritual path of, you know, daily meditation that transforms you by doing it every single day for your whole life. That's the awareness with which I tried to bring to both my career and my motherhood. They weren't different.
Thank you. I want to just say to everyone listening, Britta and I recorded a podcast episode months ago. I was still pregnant and I lost the recording. I deleted it without it being uploaded to my podcast platform. And so this is definitely a deepening of that original conversation. I'm still so sad that we lost that original conversation, but I'm so grateful for you and the way that you supported me in my pregnancy and are supporting me in my postpartum. For me, you are a very trustworthy guide and resource, and I'm just very grateful to you and grateful to have a deepening sense that the pause is safe mm-hmm. and purposeful. So that's what I get from you.
Well, I am happy to hear that, because I think the pause is purposeful in a way that isn't necessarily forward motion. And let's revalue the power and purpose of pause without forward motion. That's got value all its own. Yeah. I really appreciate these conversations that we have. I mean, this one just felt like a conversation, truly. I feel like our first version of this was more interview-like and talked about things. And yeah. I feel like today was you and I having a conversation that we would have if the recording weren't on. And I hope that the listeners enjoyed eavesdropping and being a part of that intimacy, because that's also something I think we're all hungry for. And so thank you for creating this space for that.
It was such a pleasure, Britta. Please tell people where to find you, what you're up to right now, and I will share tangible details of that in the show notes too.
Great. Well, Instagram is Britta Bushnell, PhD. That's also my Facebook public profile. I'm less on social media at the moment than I have been in the past, just giving myself a little bit of a pause, but I do anticipate being back in the fall. I'm, as I mentioned, in a threshold crossing of my own right now. And so I'm giving myself a little bit of space for that. My website is brittabushnell.com, and I've got a whole bunch of projects coming up in the near future. I've got an apprenticeship starting in October. I've got some postpartum circles that I'm going to be running, also starting in late October. And I've got some other juicy archetypal mythology, personal exploration things, cooking. And I'm just going to leave it at that for right now, but those will be coming in the near future too. So if any of that sounds of interest to you, go and sign up for my newsletter and, or just follow along with all of this. And I also have a podcast that is season two is coming out late September, and the podcast is Transformed with Britta Bushnell. And it isn't all birth related. It's shift, change, growth related. Yeah. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Sacred Body Podcast. I wanted to take a moment to direct your attention to a few online classes that I've created and made available for you. The first being Sacred Ground, Physical and Grief Healing for Pregnancy Loss and Abortion. This 5-part course is available to anyone who is either experiencing the postpartum experience unique to miscarriage and or abortion. And this program is really designed to give you not only tools for tending to this often invisible experience of the postpartum, but the unique nature of coming back into your body with reverence and trust. The other course is called Sex and Motherhood, and this course is a recording of a live course that I led and is an opportunity for mothers to more than reclaim their sense of sexual vitality, but to come to a point of understanding, honoring, trusting, and expressing their newfound experience of sexuality and vitality. Motherhood is a massive transformation, and for us to expect that we would ever be the same afterwards is unrealistic and oftentimes painful. It is my hope that these two courses offer you some solace, offer you some encouragement, and offer you a real sense of the fact that you are intact, you are whole, and you are sacred. See the link in the show notes. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you like this episode, please leave a comment, please share through all your channels, and you also have the opportunity to make a donation to ensure that these amazing conversations continue with ease. I appreciate you being here. I'm curious to hear how this conversation has impacted you, and I hope that you'll join us again.